It's time to turn to the WUKY Sports page with your host, Keith Elkins, revealing conversations and stories you thought you knew from prominent Kentucky sports figures. Now, here once again is Keith Elkins.
Welcome to the WUKY Sports Page podcast. With the fall meet at Keeneland underway, it's a good time to be talking with Kenny Rice, sportscaster with NBC and HDNet, known for his coverage of thoroughbred racing, college basketball, mixed martial arts, and a wide variety of other events. He, of course, covered sports in Lexington for WTVQ-TV for about 20 years, recently started a new project, the Kenny Rice Horse Racing Show, podcasts and YouTube, among many, many other awards and recognition, received an Eclipse Award for local television coverage of thoroughbred racing back in 1996. Is that right?
That doesn't seem that long ago, but it has been that long
ago.
Yeah,
it has been that long ago. It's been more than, I guess, 20 years now since you've been in local television here. The time has flown by.
Yeah, this is my 20th year with NBC, and like you say, I remember when we were all kids, you and I, years ago in this business.
Crossing paths at the high school football games
exactly.
And high school basketball games. I don't know where all the time went, but it was a lot of fun. And, of course, we'll talk to you today a little bit about that era, too. But in talking with you in 2019, you just about have to start with the Kentucky Derby, which, resulted in the really unusual finish, which normally happens about 2 minutes and 2 seconds after the horses leave the starting gate. This time it was about half an hour, and you're the reporter who has to be down there and interview the connections with the winning horse and usually the trainer, but nobody knew anything for quite a while. Take me through that process right there and how you handled it.
Well, nothing like that had ever happened to any of us before, mm-hmm. any of us, and of course nothing like that had ever happened at the Kentucky Derby. So when the race was over, my assignment was Bob Baffert that day. He had three horses in there, and so none of them happened to do that well. So then my next assignment was to get out front. And when, as I'm walking through, I'm hearing about the inquiry signs being put up. Not an inquiry, an objection was mm-hmm. put up by one of the jockeys. And I'm having, you know how it is, Keith, when you're out there, you listen to this. You're not actually seeing it till I got out front. And then I'm looking around and I see Bill Mott standing there. Well, I realize that Country House, his horse, is in second place at this moment. But they're already doing an interview with Jason Service, the apparent winner mm-hmm. of Maximum Security. And so I figure the next best thing, and that just comes from years of experience, well, someone has to talk to Bill Mott eventually. And then as we got up to the 6-minute mark and the 7-minute mark of this, the producers were aware I was with Mott, and that's when I talked to him. And he gave a great statement, which turned out to be prophetic, where he said if this were a race in the middle of the week, eight-horse field or whatever he said, something to that effect, the horse would have already been taken down. I'd been moved up, and he was right. I mean, I think the stewards made a good call, but that was a long 22 minutes because no one, and you can understand with litigation and the way things are, lawyers are involved in everything these days. I just knew if they make this decision, probably either way it goes, somebody's probably going to sue somebody, and the stewards were nowhere to be seen. And we talked to them all every Thursday before the Derby, the whole 20 years I've been doing this with NBC. And instead, they had no response. And we just wanted them to come on, as they do in an NFL game, where they explain the rule, mm-hmm. not to have a give and take or anything, just explain the rule of interference. And so, that was a long 22 minutes on everybody's part. And hopefully we don't happen to see that again. And quite honestly, I believe that all the things that happened this year with Santa Anita and all the problems with the horse deaths and the tragedies they had out there, very conscientious about horse safety. And if you look back on that, Maximum Security could have caused a terrible collision. Fortunately, he didn't, but he did interfere. And it is always a rough run race when they have that many horses in the field. And as it turned out, they made a good call. I wish they'd have been a little more transparent in explaining the rules to the public, because I think a lot of people left Churchill Downs that day still wondering why Country House, who was not interfered with, specifically him, was not interfered with, but he had interfered with other horses, Maximum Security, so he had to be taken, his number had to be put back, taken down, as they'll say. And it was a confusing time. But, our ratings were bigger. In those 22 minutes, I guess people were calling each other and said, this Kentucky Derby's nuts. We don't even know who's winning this thing now. And so that made for a good ratings get for NBC probably is as good, better actually than if Maximum Security had like a 20 length victory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the audience built as the drama went on. You mentioned having to kind of shift gears there as things began to happen and as you began to realize just what was happening with the objection. We all look back on things that we've done and think, well, I could have done this or I could have done that. But it sounds like you feel like you made the right call and handled it well based on your experience. You did the absolute best thing that you could at that time?
Yeah, I came through the tunnel, and as you know, you walk from the paddock out to the tunnel. I was in the paddock with Bob, and then I walked back out front, and Baffert and I have a great friendship, and you know, he looked at me and said, it's just not my day, which is the way it goes in horse racing. So I said, I'll see you down the road. I started walking out front. I figure at that stage they probably had the winning trainer, and they did. I could hear the interview in my earpiece as I was walking through, but then I kept hearing this talk about the hold on, we got this objection, we're looking into it, and then they start playing it back, and I'm listening to all this, and then when I get out front and they're replaying it on the big board, I'm seeing it. I go, well, that's interference. Mm-hmm. And a couple of people I knew said that I trusted said that horse is going to be taken down, I believe. And I go over to Bill Mott then, and before I was ever on the air with him, I said, you think they're going to take him down? He said, I don't know. It looks like interference to me, and that's when I had a feeling, because Bill's not one to really make predictions about anything. Mm-hmm. Even when he had the Great Cigar, for example, he never made predictions he was going to win those races. And so that's why, yeah, and you know how it is. We broadcast for so long that some things can't be taught in a classroom that you do have to go on instinct. And the best thing was to stay with Bill Mott the rest of the day because Jason Service was covered by one of our other reporters. And it was going to be one of those two guys. Either he was going to stay up or not. Somebody was going to be happy. Somebody was going to be disappointed.
And you mentioned building up the experience and the relationships, and you've done that, of course, with people all across racing for many, many years. Tell us about the preparation for the Derby in particular. You're part of a big team from NBC, and you've gotten to know these guys in other circumstances, but I would assume there's a chance to touch base with them again shortly before the race, or at least in the days leading up to the race, so that they know where you're going to be, they know who you are, and they know that you're going to want to talk to them at a certain time. And even though it might be a very difficult time to talk to them.
We start our meetings. We actually start exchanging some ideas a few months out. There's some obvious ones. What horses look good? You always look at a guy like Bob Baffert or Todd Pletcher. They're usually going to have multiple horses that have a chance. In this case, Maximum Security was a really good horse, looked like coming in, much like California Chrome or Smarty Jones had been, where its trainer's not usually in the Triple Crown. And they have a really special horse. So you kind of go all the possible scenarios. And then as we get ready, I'll get the format usually on what they want from me. And then they allow me, as they do all of our reporters, we write our own script. You know, tell us a story about this. Or if I have something, I say, I think, and we've again touched on this beforehand, you know, let's go back. Remember I sent you that email. I think this might be a better angle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have discussions. And sometimes it's good. Well, it's always good, but sometimes it works out a little better that I get to do what I want to do more. Mm-hmm. But then I always contact every trainer that I'm going to do an interview with and make sure I know where they are. And I have their phone numbers. And fortunately, it's a lot better now than 20 years ago where you could text or call immediately and find out. And with Baffert, we've had a lot of fun because I never know where he's going to be. I really don't. And honestly, I don't think he does. Sometimes he's going to walk over and then he'll send me a text maybe 10 minutes and say, I'm not going to walk over. Why don't you come over here? And I'll send him a text back. Why don't you notify me earlier? Yeah. Get over. But, you know, it's been a fun, good relationship. And you know, like it is, because I have been covering this sport for a long time. And not just at NBC. Did some work with ESPN, of course, before that. And then even at 36, you know, we always went and covered the Derby because at that time it was ABC mm-hmm. did the Derby. And we always did pre-race specials and things. So, being around him, and a lot of times just by eye contact. Like when I saw Bill Mott, he knew I wanted to talk to him. And I've known Billy for 25 years or more. And he knew, he kind of gave me a half grin. He knew, he didn't want necessarily to be talking about it, but he knew I was going to have to ask it. And I think there's a mutual respect that I'd be fair with him, and so it went.
And certainly that means a lot to build up that relationship where there is that respect. But it seems like in conversations I hear with racing people under those circumstances, they tend to handle those situations generally pretty well, even when they might be frustrated with how the ride went or just the how the horse finished or how it ran or if there's something else on their mind about the horse's well-being. They seem to be able to handle that that public presence pretty well, and most are able to keep the frustrations under control. Has that been the case for you? Have you noticed that?
Mostly, Keith, the horse race is a lot like golf and tennis. There is a decorum.
Yes.
Except when California Chrome lost the Belmont and was denied the Triple Crown, and I interviewed the co-owner, Steve Coburn, who became very adamant that all the horses did not run in all the Triple Crown races, and fresh horses should not be allowed to come in and challenge a horse going for a Triple Crown. And he called them cheaters, in his words.
You don't hear that very often.
And when that interview was going on, because that was nothing like ever heard before on horse racing, and I don't know if we'll ever hear something like that again, because as you mentioned, there's a certain status that you're supposed to maintain, a dignity, if you will. And the thing is, Coburn was, shot from the hip even when he won the Preakness. You might remember he blasted Churchill Downs the way they were treated at the Derby. So, you know, he was a guy that just kind of, he was a good cowboy guy from out west. And when he first said we're cheaters and nobody should be allowed to have a horse in here that hasn't run in all the Triple Crown, then that, as soon as he was saying, I thought, this is gold. I'm staying with this interview. I've got to follow up. And I did and got some nice reviews out of it. And probably boxing and mixed martial arts trained me for that, because with these with these fighters, you never know what's going to happen. And most of the time, it's going to be kind of a confrontational thing if they've had a tough loss. And so I was ready for Coburn. And I've seen him since then, and he understood. I was doing what I had to do. And the thing is, I gave him a platform. And I remember afterwards, one of our producers asked me, said, I bet he changed his mind. I said, I bet he won't soon. I bet he won't. And it was about 2 or 3 days later when finally some of the horse people got to him and said, you know, eventually you're going to stand this horse at Stallion. You need to smooth things over. You just called most of the industry a liar and a cheater, you know. And he did, but he stuck to his guns for about 48, 72 hours after the fact. And you could tell it was emotional, because he was so certain. I'd interviewed him prior to the race, and he was certain that he was going to win. He felt that it was almost like destiny that this would be the Triple Crown winner. And I remember one thing specifically. He said, I don't think we'll ever see another Triple Crown winner in my lifetime. And then, of course, American Pharoah wins the next year.
Yeah, the people that you've met over the years in racing, and of course you've got a new project now, the Kenny Rice Horse Racing Show, and I'd like to get into that in more detail a little bit later. But the idea of interviewing the people associated with the horses, they're such a wide cast of characters and such interesting, and I'm sure in your mind, great people that you've met over the years, and those are memories that you'll take in addition to these great races too.
Yeah, and I've got some good friendships. I mean, you know, Mike Pegram, who owned Real Quiet and Silver Bullet Day, has been a good friend to me for all these years. He and Bob Baffert have had several horses like Real Quiet and Silver Bullet Day together. Bob Baffert and his family, I was building a new house in 2015, and Bob sent me a text and said, I need your new address. I just moved in. This was after the Breeders' Cup, after Pharoah had won, completing what they call the Grand Slam when he won the Breeders' Cup Classic. And so I sent him the address. I didn't know where this was going. And the next day I got this really nice handwritten note and packaged FedEx overnight. It was one of Pharoah's horseshoes from his last workout leading up to the Breeders' Cup Classic. And Bob had signed it on the back. And we've had a good friendship. Gary Stevens, Mike Smith, two jockeys, Jerry Bailey, who I work with at NBC. These are people I actually call friends. You have a lot of acquaintances, but there's people I can call up and we talk and stay in touch, and we know a little bit about each other's family, how everybody's doing, and that makes it nice. And then there's been some, when I first started out, horse racing is not a welcoming business. Mm-hmm. You might have experienced some of that.
Well,
they don't bring you right in if they think that you're naive about something or you're trying to learn something. A lot of those guys will mess with your head, and they did mine when I first started. When I first came to Channel 36 in 1980, and I was just trying to learn horse racing a little bit. I didn't grow up in this world. I grew up in a coal mining area of eastern Kentucky, and I'd only seen one live horse race as at Keeneland when I was a senior at UK. I mean, I watched the Derby on TV, but Yeah, it was interesting that nobody took me under their wing and started saying, let me show you the ropes. I kind of had to fight through it a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you about the language of horse racing. That was one barrier that I found in trying to report a little bit on it. And there is a language that, and a jargon, and of course you find that in most fields, but it seems to be especially true in horse racing. And like you say, at least at that time, maybe it's changed some since then for newer people, but there seemed to be at least a little bit of a barrier. That may have been in my mind as well as theirs, but at the same time, it can you feel like you're kind of trying to break down a door a little bit sometimes, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, it honestly, this was not the sport that I thought I would be most associated with if you'd asked me 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's turned out that way, and it's been an entree to do some other things with NBC and led to some work with Mark Cuban's network and some other things. So that's been wonderful. But when I first started trying to learn it, and I find to this day, they want you to come out and bet, they being the PR people and all behind the horse racing. And no mistake, gambling drives the sport. If people aren't making bets at Keeneland or Churchill or wherever they are, the sport's going to go belly up. So I understand that to a point, but it really makes it difficult to learn about the people and a little bit of the jargon, and they'll tell you. I remember one old guy told me, he said he worked 5/8 today in a minute 20. Well, that's brutally slow. I mean, that's like turtle slow. Mm-hmm. You know, he was like 58 to a minute. I mean, that's, you know, that's 58's about right what you'd want. And I didn't know at that time. I mean, okay, 5/8 of a mile, a minute 20, I guess. I'm trying to put in human terms. That's pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
And little things like that. But I met Wayne Lucas, who was still kind of an outcast himself in 1980. He had won the Preakness with Codex, but he was still considered that quarter horse trainer. And Lucas knew I liked basketball, which is still my favorite sport. And he had been an assistant basketball coach, freshman basketball coach at the University of Wisconsin. And so we taught basketball. So he would explain horse racing to me in basketball terms. And that helped me a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was very, very lucky to meet him early on. And then I met a few other people, Woody Stevens, one of the legendary trainers, was very nice to me early. And then a lot of the horse people, once they saw me coming out at their farm and trying to do stories and showing interest, they reciprocated. You know, the Hancock brothers, Arthur and Seth, Will Farish at Lane's End Farm, J.T. Lundy was at Calumet Farm at that time. These people were especially nice to me and would help me out. But some of those old trainers, until you prove yourself, until they show, you know, once you come back about the third or fourth year, they figure, well, you're not leaving, and you might be interested. But it wasn't instant establishment at all.
Yeah, you have to prove that you're not not a one and done.
That's
you're not
right.
Coming out and doing a feature today, and then we'll never see you again. You mentioned growing up in Eastern Kentucky, and whenever someone asks about you, and I know your hometown is Eastern, Kentucky.
Yeah.
So I always put the comma in there. That's the name of the town in Floyd County, right?
Right.
And so as you say, that's people are familiar with the Derby, and they know about horse racing, but they don't follow it, generally speaking, to the extent that someone around here would. So it is something new. But let's go back to the start there. I believe you worked in radio in Prestonsburg in high school.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. Started out when I was 15 at WDOC Radio in Prestonsburg.
Yeah.
And I was a disc jockey, and at night, my dad, because I didn't even have a permit at that time. I had no driver's license. My dad would drive me and drop me off and come pick me up at the station in the summers, you know, between my sophomore and junior year of high school, and I monitored Cincinnati Reds baseball games.
Yeah.
And, you know, the deal, I'd come on like, you know, top and bottom of the hour. You had to give the ID then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was WDOC radio with a 75,000 watts of power in the tri-state area. I can pretty much remember it, you know,
sure.
It's 78 degrees and at 9:30, and now back to Al Michaels and the Reds baseball.
Yeah.
And later on, I got to work with Al on a boxing series that NBC had about 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd worked with his brother, who had been a producer when I first started. He produced the horse racing shows. So I'd met Al a couple of times, but we got to know each other a little better, and I told him that story about how I used to throw it back to
sure.
I said, every now and then I'd give you a plug. Sometimes I'd say Reds baseball, but most time I'd say Al Michaels. He got a kick out of that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that was fun. But I did that, and then I got out of high school and really started calling ball games, everything. We did women's softball tournaments, Little League baseball games, and then, you know, high school football, baseball, basketball. Pretty much if there was a sport, you know, our sales staff sold it.
Sure.
And
what a learning lab the small town stations are. I mean,
The best thing I ever did was a show called Swap Shop. Now, if you grew up in a small town, you might be familiar with that.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And now this was 75, somewhere in this time. So, you know, there was also more of civility among people. People were afraid to curse on the air. Mm-hmm. I'm even talking about those calling in.
Yes.
That, like, they'd be tracked down by the FCC and beaten or arrested. So we did not have a delay. Mm-hmm. Imagine trying to do that these days.
Oh, no.
You couldn't.
No.
And so we didn't have a delay. And, you know, people calling, you might call, hey, I'm Keith. I've got four tires. One's a little bald, but they're pretty good. Okay, thanks, Keith. Write down, what's your number? And then somebody, hey, you remember Keith called a few minutes ago? What was that tire? How many tires do you have? Yeah, here's his number. You know, you couldn't do that nowadays, mm-hmm. but you had to think on your feet, because somebody would always call in and say they got Prince Albert in a can, or yeah. Is your refrigerator running? And, you know, and you had to kind of play it off. And sometimes somebody would call in with a really sad story. They were in desperate need of money and were mm-hmm. trying to sell something. And so you just kind of learn by doing. And
yeah.
I still think in pretty much everything that I've learned, well, I've learned by doing. That's even like fixing some basic plumbing. I'm not hawking myself out there because I'm lousy at it, but I can, like, do a few things, you know, my dad showed me.
Yeah, some of those plumbing things are absolutely by necessity.
Yeah, yeah,
sure.
You know, yeah. Yeah. So I can do a few things. Believe me, I'm not the guy that's going to be moving out by and living, you know, 100 miles away from everybody by himself. I would if I was more advanced. I might do that someday.
Yeah, I need to be on the grid and on the water
system.
I'm
with you, man.
Sure.
I'm with you.
Yeah, it's just very much a side interest at best. But you had a chance to develop your skills at that point, and then by that time, I would think you had decided that this is something I at least want to more seriously explore as you went to college.
Yeah, you know, when I was about 15, Keith, I tell you, because growing up, my dad was a terrific athlete. And actually, when he got out of the Army, he had turned down some opportunities to play college basketball. He played for an Army team, and they traveled the East, and he taught cadets how to fuel in combat. They'd mm-hmm. send him off to special class. He taught that during Korea War. And so, but he wanted to come back to Kentucky and helped his father in a coal mine and married my mother. And so he came back home, but we always grew up with that love of sports, and I'm a big St. Louis Cardinal fan to this day because my grandfather was. For whatever reason, KMOX radio was picked up in the mountains at that time better than WLW out of Cincinnati. My father grew up with Stan Musial. I grew up with Bob Gibson and Kurt Flood and Lou Brock. And we'd watch that Wide World of Sports together.
Mm-hmm.
And at Jim McKay, I thought, man, that's the greatest thing. You can see the world, and you got to cover sports. I think I'd like to do that because I'm not the smartest guy. I'm not going to be I'm not going to be a brain surgeon, but I could maybe do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, much to the chagrin of every guidance counselor I had, who told me I should go into pharmacy or something more secure, I said, "Well, I want to be a broadcaster." He said, "What are you going to do? Work at WDOC till you die?" And I said, "Well, nothing wrong with that if you wanted to, but I think I might have a future in this. Might do some things." And then, thank God, it did. It kind of worked out. I remember this could never happen to this day. Channel 36 had an opening for a weekend sports guy in 1980. I'd been out of school for about 3 months. And my old high school basketball coach and old biology teacher had a little cable TV station that I'd done some work for them in the past year calling high school games. Now, again, remember, this is 79 and 80. So we would tape the games on, like, Friday and Saturday nights and play them back, like, Saturday and Sunday mornings. And then it was, wow, huge. And, you know, we'd go to the far corners of the 15th region, you know, mm-hmm. from Belfry right on the West Virginia border and then all over Floyd County and Johnson County, and they'd play them back. And so we buddied together. It was all jump cuts. It, you know, nowadays it laughed at me. But we put it together. A guy that lived in Wheelwright was a friend of the family. His ex-brother-in-law had worked at Channel 36 in the sales department. Apparently, they maintained a decent friendship.
Yeah, that doesn't always happen.
It does. He said, "Let me give it to my ex-brother-in-law. Give me that tape." And we get a little VHS tape. And we sent it to his brother-in-law. The brother-in-law took it over to Channel 36. And I got a phone call, and they asked me if I'd come down for an audition.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that wouldn't happen anymore.
That would be very unconventional practice, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that's how I got into it.
So. And also, it was just about that time, really, that the stations were beginning to expand sports coverage a little bit and even have a second guy.
Right.
Because I was the first second guy.
I remember that.
So,
you were Channel 18 when I came to town.
Right.
Yeah. And that was it.
Yeah, so a lot of things, things kind of fall into place there. And it was a pretty good era, I think, to cover sports in the late 70s, early 80s, because UK had the national championship in 78, and they had the great football team in 77. Eastern Kentucky University was making a great run in football at that time, too, with a couple of national championships in 79 and 82. And covered the Cincinnati teams, we all did.
Yeah.
And so it was Lexington's, I think, always been a really good market to cover a variety of sports.
Yeah, I always thought that it was interesting. You know how TV people are. and probably still are. What size market are you in?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how big is your market? And, you know, you'd go on the road. We'd go up to Cincinnati. I remember Cincinnati and Louisville would sometimes look down on us like, oh, Lexington's here. Like the poor brothers are here. You know, let's take them in. And I always thought, you know, really, they're close to Cincinnati, just like you said, for college football, which was not very good. It had moments. But at least you got to see SEC teams come in, you know. And basketball, obviously, I don't think it gets any better. And horse racing, you know, I thought Lexington was a lot better sports market than the actual market size, which is, you know, just based on the population of the area that you're in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I decided, heck, I really didn't want to go too many places. I had a couple of chances, but I decided to stay. And, you know, thankfully it worked out okay.
Yeah, and you got some good opportunities there. There wasn't a whole lot of TV play-by-play opportunities available at that time, except for our friends out at Channel 27, and they are our friends, but they had the tie-up with UK at that time and did a lot of UK broadcasts. But if memory serves, and it doesn't serve as well, it's hard to get good service these days, you know. But didn't you get to do a broadcast of a UK game from Alaska, in the Great Alaska Shootout?
Yes.
Yeah, tell me about that.
I did two of them, actually. In 85, Eddie Sutton's first year, we went to Hawaii because the Shamrock Broadcasting, Roy Disney, Walt Disney's nephew, owned us.
Mm-hmm.
We were one of like seven or eight stations that he owned and a few radio stations. Their flagship station was in Honolulu. So whatever reason, they worked it out, and we got on a plane, three of us did, and we flew over there and did the UK Chaminade game. And then in 1988... we went and did the Great Alaska Shootout. Jack Givens actually was the analyst on that, and we flew up to Alaska. And I remember we got off the plane, and it was cold. It was exceptionally cold, even for November. They'd actually had one of their first big snowfalls, and we got off the plane. It was midnight, and we're walking out of the terminal and had to walk across the street to the parking garage to get the rental car. And I looked up, and it said 0 degrees. You know, that time and temperature thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember looking at Givens. I said, man, this is like when people first come to Kentucky and the first guy they see is barefoot.
Yeah.
You know, they think that, hey, look, I'm in Alaska and there's snow on the ground. It's 0 degrees at midnight and the wind's howling and we got to be in the gym tomorrow afternoon.
Mm. Yeah. But that still must have been a great memory and a great chance to do play-by-play for an opportunity that didn't come along very long.
Yeah, you know, because I thought, you know, I mean, eventually, I originally was going to do, because I did all this play-by-play in radio when I started out and things. And, you know, 36 was not a competitive in that sport. And everybody kind of conceded to 27. They, you know, they had the lock-in with UK, and, you know, they were good business people, and they kept the lock-in with UK. So it shut out 18 and 36. And it did help 27 expand. You know, the first Kentucky station we got, I grew up watching West Virginia TV.
Mm-hmm.
The first Kentucky station I got was 27. The only reason we got that, it wasn't that their news was better. It's just that they had UK basketball games.
Right.
And everybody wants to see UK basketball games, you know, and that's it. And I think they would admit that, too. And I've got friends over there, and, you know, they've had people work there a long time and been very successful. But, you know, that was the key. And, you know, I did Ohio Valley Conference basketball Friday night. Do you remember that?
Yes. Yeah, I sure do.
Jim Delaney came to us because Johnny Carson, nobody was going to interrupt Johnny Carson on NBC. Mm-hmm. And Delaney was the boy wonder commissioner of the OVC then, obviously went on later to become the Big Ten commissioner. And his deal was, I can't go to the South SEC. I can't compete with the SEC on a Saturday. Can't go to the North and compete with the Big Ten. We're going to have Friday night live, and we're going to do these games. And at that time, Youngstown and Akron were in the league, along with the Kentucky and Tennessee schools. And so he did it. So I did that for like 2 or 3 years. And it was fun because, you know, you go to a place like Moorhead, that wouldn't have a big crowd, but they'd have a big crowd for that Friday night, kind of the novelty.
Sure.
And the fraternities and sororities, some of them come out, they'd all be dressed like in their bathrobes or something.
Mm-hmm.
And where we did Youngstown games and guys coming off the second shift, you know, big factory town, they'd come to the games. And that was a lot of fun. But I enjoyed doing that. I've always enjoyed that. And I like the live sports events. It just being able to react to something live. Boxing, basketball, football, it's just really special.
Yeah, just like in a sense, it's a parallel to how, what the athletes feel. That there's nothing quite like game night when you're at the live event. And if you're going to be calling that live event, it just is that much more exciting to feel a part of. And again, not to compare it to an athlete's experience, but there is at least a little bit of similarity there in that you are feeling the mood of the crowd and all of that. It's a very special thing, I think.
No, I agree. And, you know, probably like these guys that are playing it, they get a little bored if it's a dull game. You do too. Well, at least I did.
Sure.
You know, you guys say, hey, I got to keep that energy up, you know, and a good game kind of speaks for itself, you know. But I think that's a great analogy you made, Keith, because you do. You prepare. You feel you're prepared. You go in, and then if something changes, you feel like you're prepared enough to change on the fly.
Mm-hmm. Now, Ed, I want to ask you about the departure then from WTVQ, but before I do that, let me ask you about another play-by-play event that you did, and I believe you and our friend Jeff Parrott did the first Lexington Legends game. Isn't that right?
We did. Yeah. We did. I was gone from 36, and the guy had come in, was a general manager, was our sales manager when I was there. And he called and he said, would you come back? And I said, well, why not? You know, yeah, I mean, that'd be fun. And he said, yeah, you'd like to do this Lexington Legends. We're doing the first game. And I said, well, good for 36 to finally beat 27 out in something. You know,
step up and
you know,
take the lead.
And, and I say that in terms of endearment, you know, that it's good to have friendly competition.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeff Parrott was going to do it. Jeff and I have been friends for a long time since he played at Lafayette and then UK and went to the majors. And I actually saw him pitch a couple times. I stopped in when he was playing in the majors. And we had a blast doing it. I think like 8,000 and some. They had this huge crowd, and it was a big deal. And we later on did also the Southern League All-Star game that year.
Mm-hmm.
They played it up here. We did two games that year. And I hope we got the South Atlantic
South
League.
South Atlantic League.
I said Southern
League. Legends are in. Yeah,
mm-hmm. South Atlantic League.
Mm-hmm.
And God, what was that, 2001?
2001.
Yeah.
And the thing I remember about that opening night, I was not there, but of course followed closely and saw some of your broadcast, but it was about 81 degrees and sunny. Now, how often does that happen on the first Thursday in April in Lexington? You could have been closer to your night in Alaska, I think, than expect to have 81 degrees. But it was perfect. It was like Alan Stein had scripted the whole thing.
I told Stein. I said it worked. And I believe you because he had – see, that's why I remember the attendance, because it seemed like it was something like 8303 or something. Because remember, you used to run 803 South?
Oh, I remember it well, yes.
And it was somewhere that Alan would know, obviously, exactly. But I think I know there was 8 and a 3 and an 0 and a 3 worked in there somehow. And 8,000 was the key.
Yeah. That almost sounds like Alan may have adjusted.
Well,
that,
you know, I don't want to throw suspicion on that. But I do know that it was a packed house, and I was glad to see it.
It really was a legitimate 8,000 people
there.
He might have added the 03 in there.
Yeah.
But it was quite an occasion and such a great debut for baseball, and I would think a great thing to be a part of as a broadcaster. And, of course, that turned out to be a great Legends team, too, that went on to win the championship.
Yeah, you know, that was great. And I remember listening to you do the Legends games. I love that. I love to listen to baseball. I don't know. I just always enjoy listening to baseball. I think it's the most challenging thing to call.
Mm-hmm.
I think the horse race is the most challenging thing for that moment because, you know, if you mess up, geez. Especially on a big – it's not like you can get a – you can't I'm trying to think. Clem McCarthy, the old broadcaster back in the 30s, where you can't lateral a horse.
Right.
You know,
right.
Back then, if you were listening to a game and if you got the wrong football guy, he laterals.
Mm-hmm.
It's at the 5. Hold it. He laterals. You know, so what? Nobody thought of that. But, I mean, you know, to fill the time and be able to tell the stories like you did so well when you did the Legends games and things, I mean, that's a real skill set. And I love to listen to great baseball announcers.
Baseball and radio, I think, have always had a special relationship, and that continues to this day. There are a lot of ways to follow your team now, and you can follow it online with the game day and the information and all of that. And not that there's anything wrong with that, but there's certainly nothing wrong with the baseball broadcast now either. And we're seeing even now, you know, Marty Brenneman is getting ready to retire. Vin Scully retired a couple of years ago. So some of the voices that we were familiar with for so many years are stepping away from the game, but there will be others, and I think baseball and radio will continue that relationship into the future.
I think so. I remember my dad and I almost every night listened to KMOX when Harry Carey was the main guy and Jack Buck was the second guy.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, again, during some of the Cardinals' heydays in the 60s. I remember when Orlando Cepeda came over and all that. And and one of my favorite memories is I did an interview segment at Channel 36 for a couple of years. They were trying to figure out what can we do at 5 o'clock, especially after ESPN really got a little more popular, and you're seeing all the highlights. At that time when I first started, you remember when we were doing it back in the early 80s, you couldn't get a highlight. I mean, it was a big deal to see a highlight. So even if you had to play it back on Monday, it wasn't like you regurgitated
right.
it. For a lot of people, they were seeing it for the first time. And then as that changed, they called me in the back there, the general manager at that time, said, I don't know, I'd like to keep sports in the 5 o'clock segment, but I don't know what to do. I said, how about we'd have a conversation on Mondays? And we just talk about anything they want to talk about. We don't necessarily talk about the big game. And, you know, we got some pretty good guests on, but my favorite was I called and got Harry Carey on.
Oh, yeah.
And I called the Cubs, and I said, I'd like to have Harry Carey. I told him who I was, what I did, and they said, well, call the Drake Hotel. He's over there. I said, well, who do I talk to? He said, well, talk to Harry Carey. I said, did he have like a public relations guy? Yeah. Man, no, just call. So I called and I said, is Harry Carey at like his room? And the next day I heard, hello. And I said, Harry, yes. And I told him who I was and what I wanted. He said, you know, I said, I know she'll be in Cincinnati next week. He said, you know, meet me at this time. And I met him. And what started out to be like about a 15-minute conversation, we ran through, that was those old 3/4-inch 20-minute tape jobs.
Yeah.
We got to our fourth one.
Oh, wow.
That's how long. We did over an hour with him, and he was telling stories from Stan Musial and Gas House days to when he met Elvis Presley.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was just a treat. And I told him, you know, growing up listening to him, it was just a treat. You know, it felt like he was in my house every night almost in the summer.
Yeah, they actually did seem to have a presence with you all the way there. The soundtrack of your summer is the phrase a lot of people use, and we have something in common there. I'm also a lifelong Cardinals fan.
That's why I always liked you, Keith.
Yeah, that's right. It must have stood out there. Yeah. But I grew up in southern Indiana, and after the 1960 season, our hometown radio station switched from the Reds broadcast to the Cardinals broadcast. Had they waited a year, they probably would have stayed with the Reds long term because the Reds won the pennant the next
year.
But they went to the Cardinals, and I heard Harry Carey and Jack Buck, and I really like them and already had developed some interest in the Cardinals. But the overall point being not that I'm a Cardinals fan, but just the relationship that you gain with those broadcasters because they are there every night. And you know which guys are injured. In a couple more weeks, he'll be back. And this is how the team is shaping up. And they were your way of following the team. And it really does stimulate your interest in broadcasting. I think a lot of broadcasters will tell you that. And then later on, visits to radio stations and things like that will let you know if you do have a serious interest in it or not. But the first real relationship you have with the guy on the radio can have a lot to do with, if you're a broadcaster, how your life turns out, I think.
It truly does. And, you know, I used to get on at night. You can't do it as much now because the AM frequencies and all the air thing, I don't understand it all. I just know I don't get them as much.
Right.
But I used to listen to Joe Tate, 3WE Cleveland, called Cleveland Cavaliers Games.
Mm-hmm.
And I always enjoyed that. And I used to order in the back of Sporting News. They had these records. I don't know if you remember that. You could order them for like $2.95 at that time, and I'd save my money, and I'd order and listen to all these different guys like Bill King out in Oakland who called games, Marv Albert, who I later had a chance to work boxing with. What a terrific guy. Called the Knicks games. You know, I'd listen to these guys from all over the country. Skip Carey was a terrific baseball announcer. He was a very good play-by-play basketball announcer, too, because one of my favorite players next to Dan Issel at that time was Pete Maravich, with a lot of kids that grew up in the South. And he was calling Maravich games when Maravich was a rookie with the Atlanta Hawks.
Yeah.
And so I'd listen. You could tune in 3WE Cleveland, WSB, and listen to these at night. And you'll pick it up pretty clear, just like you could KMOX in St. Louis. And so I like to listen to different voices and even different accents to a point and different ways of describing things. Chick Hearn out in Los Angeles, I got a record, you know, where he's calling like the season of the Lakers in 72 and all that. I mean, I still have those.
Yeah.
Some of them are kind of scratched up now, but I used to listen to them all the time and take notes.
Yeah. I have the vinyl of the Cardinals highlights in 64 and 67.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I haven't listened to them for a long time, but I can remember just the phrasing they use, things like that. And you can learn as an announcer. And of course, obviously you're going to be entertained as a fan, and then it makes great for memories as you go on through life. And to look back now, more than 50 years have passed since those years, which is really hard to believe. But it does stay with you. Hey, I want to ask you, and shifting gears quite a bit here, but one of your assignments at WTVQ, in addition to covering, we talked about covering racing and covering the other sports, but you usually hosted or was a co-host of their coverage of the Anita Madden party.
I knew that was it.
Is that, you knew where I was going with that? And so, you know, you met racing people in a different sort of setting there, but what was that like? Because for those who are too young or maybe weren't paying attention at that time, but the Anita Madden party was really one of the big events on the calendar as far as Lexington social life was concerned and leading into the racing season, and it was a real who's who, if not the A-list, the A-minus list of celebrities, and you were covering them. What was that like?
Well, you know, probably to this day, it's the highest-rated show Channel 36 has ever had. I mean, honestly, there were people, I would guess at that time we might have had 70%.
Mm-hmm.
Only because, one, there were still three networks. You didn't have all the choices as you have now. And two, you know, a lot of people had heard about these parties. They were a bit of infamy about these parties because they were private for a long time. President Reagan changed a lot of that when he some of this tax exemption for the horse people was taken away. In other words, lavish parties couldn't be written off like they used to be. So they opened it up to the public. They included the Boys and Girls Ranch that the state police were associated with and sold public tickets. Mm-hmm. But still, it was a kind of a pricey ticket. Not everybody could go. You know, you even if you walked, you couldn't walk up to the door or the tent in this case. So people would tune in, and honestly, Keith, I think they tune in to see if there'd be, like, nudity or something crazy going on. You know, they didn't know what in the world is this party about, and there were places that we wouldn't put our cameras. We'd put them in the tent, and we'd get generic shots, but we wouldn't go too far back into the tent.
Well, you always got to be careful what's in the background back there.
That's because... it. And Sky Yancey and I, we'd anchored together, Sky and I were positioned at the entrance of the tent, so nobody was really behind. I think a couple of years they had a... behind us, but it wasn't lit very well on purpose, so you could kind of get an idea of people were up there behind us, but if they were naked, you wouldn't have seen them.
Yeah.
And, yeah, we had some, and I was, as you know, with local TV, if they can sell something, they will sell the living out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And because we were still ABC, and ABC at that time did the Derby, I had to go up there every morning to Churchill Downs and do a report and file reports. I was doing like 3 reports a day. And a Derby special that would air like on Thursday nights prior to the Derby. And so by Friday, I was just punchy.
Yeah.
And I'd get up there, and Sky, I told her, I said, look, you got to carry me on these soap opera people. Susan Lucci's the only one I know. I don't know anybody in soap opera. I don't watch soap operas. And she'd always handle that. And people would always call, I guess because I just kind of was a little flippant about it, they'd always call and say, man, Kenny's drunk. How do you let him on the air? And the thing is, I never drank. I've never been a drinker.
Yeah.
One of the few vices I've actually avoided, but I never did drugs, never drank, and but they'd always call in. I guess because I just went with the flow, and I thought you had to almost be a little over the top and crazy doing that because, I mean, Terry Hatcher one year comes in. This was during the height of Lois and Clark. You know, Superman was Dean Cain, and Terry Hatcher is a well built woman.
Yes,
and she
yes.
had on a dress that was at least a size or two too small for her.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the only time they got in my ear and said, we may cut, because she started talking that she had lost her dress in transit from L.A., but Mrs. Madden, Anita Madden, had gotten her one. And she said, it's a little tight. I don't know. And she started shimmying, you know.
Oh.
And I thought, boy, at any moment now, we are going to have what people have been wanting to see. Nudity is going to be on Channel 36. I got to think how it's set. And then I remember Sky Yancey stepped in with one of the great lines, and she said, Sky was not built quite like Terry Hatcher, and she started shaking too, and she said, funny, my dress doesn't do that. And Terry Hatcher suddenly she didn't know what to do, and I loved it. I thought that was just and it kind of diffused what, because Terry was pushing us right to the limit.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't know how far she was going to keep shaking, you know, but it was and then we had some. I remember we had Tom Hulse on, who was Amadeus, was won Academy Award, and he was in Animal House too. And you know, I don't know. Sometimes you didn't know if these guys were really out of it or they're playing with you. Because he kept saying, I said, was it the first time in Kentucky? He said, I don't know. Is it, where am I? I said, you're in Kentucky, you know. And then you met some people that I'm trying to think of his last name, Church Hayden, that was on Northern Exposure, and John Corbett, and some of those, Jason Priestley, 90210 was big at the time. Gail O'Grady from one of my favorite, still to this day, dramas, NYPD Blue, came in 1 year. You know, and everybody just had a fun time with it. And that was the greatest thing. We didn't have a script. We had, okay, we're going to have a block. We're going to do like 2 interviews. And then we're going to throw it to one of our roving reporters who's done something on tape, by the way. So we know it's safe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they went into the crowd and it's on safe because it's on tape, you know.
Right. And somebody's had a chance to see what's in the background.
Yeah.
Well, the Terry Hatcher moment, I guess, could be described as real and spectacular.
It was real and spectacular. That's right.
Well, you left Channel 36 in, what, 1999?
Yeah, June 99, 20 years now.
Now, that's the kind of thing where I'm sure you were beginning to get a lot of other opportunities on a freelance basis, and eventually you, like Tom Hammond had to do several years before, decide, okay, I need to make a break and take advantage of these other opportunities, or I need to decide to stay long-term here and maybe do less of these other opportunities. And what went into your decision? What made you decide to make the break at that time? Because also, for those that may not have been around at that time, you had assembled at that station a really good on-air team.
Yeah,
and Channel 36 was probably as strong as it had ever been as far as its local news presentation, and you were a big part of that.
Well, thank you for that. Yeah, and I was. You know, worked with good people. John Lindgren, Brad James did weather, and of course, the aforementioned Sky Yancey, close friend of mine today. And in 1982, I started doing some work with ESPN. They had a show called Down the Stretch. And I did a bunch of horse racing stuff. And horse racing was kind of my entree. During that time, they also allowed me to go up. I went up and covered some red stuff, you know, all on tape. Mm-hmm. Sports Center was wide open back then. You would call up there, and somebody like Chris Berman would answer the phone.
Yeah.
They were basically like a local newscast.
Right.
And I remember you had to send tapes up there. We didn't have a satellite at 36. They didn't. They had one satellite in Bristol at that time, if people can believe this. Mm-hmm. And so what I would do is I would call them up and say, I'm sending this story, and here's what the story's about, and it's coming on Delta Dash, and it's going
Delta
to arrive
Dash.
In Hartford, Connecticut tomorrow morning at 9:30 a.m.
That, a lot of times the Dash involves you going to the airport
and
after the
me.
Event. Yeah.
I would drive. I would stay up and edit all night and take it. And so anyway, that had gone on, and I had an opportunity to leave in the late 80s, and I didn't take it. And I thought, well, I don't know. It'll come back. And nothing was coming back. And then in 97, ESPN called me again. They were starting a show called Today at the Races. And they wanted me to be the host. And so at that time, you couldn't see live racing except at the simulcast. There was no TVG or HRTV or none of this. And so I started doing that. And then I started doing a lot of horse racing. I was doing like 30 horse races a year. And all the vacation time I had at 36, and I had 3 weeks at that time, and sick days and all that, I had close to a month. I was using everything to go work. And so it had been like 3 years I didn't take a vacation. Don't feel sorry for me, okay?
Yeah.
This is what I chose. And but I thought, you know, I'm getting a lot of work. And actually, I was making more money freelancing than I was working at 36.
That's a real tipping point, too,
and,
isn't
and
it?
And I said, and then, fortunately, NBC had reached out to me and after the Derby in 99 and told me they'd like for me to be a reporter. It was going to be a one-off deal. They'd like me to do a report, be a reporter on the 99 Breeders' Cup. So I knew I had that, too. I thought, well, I'm getting to the network. Maybe it's a one-shot deal. I don't know, but I'm going to take it. And, you know, 36, I was at a ceiling, had been for a long time. They weren't going to try to expand and do play-by-play of Eastern or Moorhead or Transylvania or anything else. And, you know, hey, look, I mean, a couple of people, actually, surprisingly, Keith, were kind of offended that I left out there. And I said, well, this is not a spur of the moment. Like one day after 19 years plus, I said, I quit. And I decided that this was the opportunity, and I had enough confidence in myself that I felt if it didn't work out there that I was, you don't want to sound arrogant, but you got to have some confidence. I thought I was good enough that I could work in another market, a bigger market if I needed to. And so I went with ESPN, and then NBC called me back and said, not only are you doing the Breeders' Cup, but we're doing a six-week series leading up to the Breeders' Cup starting in September. And so I said, I'm aboard. And fortunately, it's worked out, and I've been doing that and some Olympics and boxing and MMA and some basketball, and used to be a reporter on Football Night in America. That was my hand a lot of times under Tom Brady's nose.
Okay.
I didn't get a whole lot of reports. Bob Costas has been very kind to me. Every now and then he'd mention that I interviewed him, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that was nice. But, yeah, I decided, you know, just might as well take the leap. I mean, worst scenario, they don't keep me around. Okay, now I got to find another job. That was the worst scenario. It wasn't going to be life and death. So that was not a hard decision to make. And to be honest, I kind of wish I'd been more aggressive and left local TV 5 or 6 years earlier. Mm-hmm. Nothing against people that want to stay on local TV. There's a lot. I have good friends that are. And it just what fits you. And from a sports standpoint, I'd maxed out at 36. And there was no other place to go. I was still going to be doing the same thing. I'd still be doing the same thing now as I was 20 years ago if I'd stayed. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't want to do that.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned covering boxing and MMA, and a while back we referred to Jim McKay and the wide world of sports spanning the globe to bring you the constant variety of sports. And you've kind of made that a strength of your career in that you've taken on these assignments. Maybe you it felt like you had to learn a lot really quickly about some of them, but that has really, really helped you and served you well, and I guess become a highlight for you as well.
You know, it has, Keith, and I don't want to say I'm fearless. I might be more dumb than fearless, but they say, hey, you want to do this? I say, sure. That's how I got on with Mark Cuban with HDNet. One of the producers was leaving NBC to go work for Mark, be executive producer. We had talked enough. He knew I liked other sports. When I came to NBC, they'd just seen my work on ESPN, horse racing shows. They thought I was a horse racing guy. They thought I grew up on some farm in Kentucky, and Daddy owned it, and you know I just grew up in the sport. They didn't realize I was a sports director and covered all these others, and it took me about 4 years to convince them I could do a few other things. And I got to go first with Mark Cuban's outfit, HDNet, and we did, because ESPN didn't have strangleholds on it, I got to call Pac-10 basketball. I was still Pac-10 then, West Coast Conference basketball. I remember when Gonzaga was just building, I called a few of their games out there, and then We did Missouri Valley. We had three pretty good conferences. And Mark Cuban's put a lot of money into it, and it was fun. And then in 2004, I got a call. I'd done this live shot for us, for the network, at the infield of the Kentucky Derby. And I'd been, like, almost tackled. But I didn't go down, and I didn't give up the microphone. You know, that infield crowd's nuts.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And because I didn't go down and I didn't give up the microphone, Dick Ebersol was impressed. Enough so that he asked me to be the boxing reporter and go to Athens. And I got to do my first Olympics in 2004. Mm-hmm. And then I got a call after that. It seemed to go well. And Tommy Roy, who's now with the Golf Channel and still with NBC, but the Golf Channel, he called me. He was executive producer at that time. And he said, I know you want to do some other sports, and we've got one for you. And I was thinking, oh, good, maybe Notre Dame sideline or something. Mm-hmm. Professional bull riding. He said, "Have you ever?" I said, "I've never even seen a rodeo. I know nothing about it." He said, "Well, you got about 3 weeks to learn." And they sent me to Vegas to watch the finals. And then their season kind of is almost like car racing. You know, some of their big events start really early, even after 3 weeks after their championship. So I did professional bull riding for 3 years, and that also led to me getting to do reports, as a lot of us did. They'd have like 7 or 8 reporters out there before they had the studio show the way they do now on Football Night in America. I don't know if you remember that in 2004, 2005, and 2006. And I'd do a lot of things. It would be on the web. That was a big deal then. It'd be on NBCSports.com. Mm-hmm. And then occasionally I'd get to do a hit in the main show. And so with Bob Costas was a studio host back then. That's how far back it was. And, yeah, I think being versatile and just like, you know, they'd call me up for any horse, for any animal sport, like bull riding. They've put me into equestrian. I've covered a 3 days event now. You know, I've learned it. But I had to kind of learn as go. I've done polo. I've done the U.S. Open Polo Championship because it's a horse sport.
Sure.
You know, they said, well, it's a horse sport. Come on, you cover racing, it's a horse sport. And it's fortunately, I got to do some A-10 basketball and some other things with them, too. But, yeah, I just thought that, you know, I did. And I think that wide world of sports, like you mentioned, Keith, I think that influence was there a little bit that I was fascinating seeing other sports.
Yeah.
I mean, I like football, baseball, basketball. You know, boxing, that's my favorite sports. But, you know, and horse racing, I mean, because it's been a livelihood. But, you know, that probably wouldn't be in my top 3 or 4, which might surprise people if I had a chance to go out and spend a day at a track or a day at a good high school or a good college basketball game. I'd take a good college basketball game. And I still love horse racing and the people I've met. But, you know, it's what goes back to your childhood and basketball and football and baseball especially. Mm-hmm. You know, those are the sports that I grew up with. And my dad would take me to games, and we've shared that experience. And we haven't shared too many. He's only been to one horse race with me. My mother never went. She'd watch him. She'd watch him on TV. Yeah. But we've been to boxing and MMA together and these other sports that I do. You know, he's gone with me on several of them.
Sure. And, well, that's an indicator, too. We talked a little bit about where you grew up as not being a place where people follow horse racing closely.
Yeah.
And I think your parents were probably just indicators of that because it's just not that high on the list in that part of the state, whereas it's very high in other parts
of the
state.
You know, as I tell people, you know, once you get around this state, you get outside of Louisville and Lexington, it's not like people. Now, I got friends. My cousin's a heck of a handicapper. Mm-hmm. You know, I got friends that come up here, and I know how big horse racing is for a lot of these people. But, you know, horse racing is still kind of provincial, in my opinion, even in the state of Kentucky. You get outside of Louisville and Lexington, you know, you go down to Katy's or Princeton or Owensboro, you know, maybe Pikeville. Yeah, I mean, there's people that like it, and they're going to come. And they come, but they will probably take a Kentucky basketball game over the Kentucky Derby.
Yeah.
If they had a good ticket for either one and you can only pick one, I'd say most of them would take a Kentucky basketball game. If they're playing a good team, they probably wouldn't take like Fairleigh Dickinson.
You know, no, I think fans are expressing their displeasure over there.
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah. Well, you know, as you say, though, the horse racing also, in a way, for you kind of fell into the same category at that time as mixed martial arts did later or boxing did later or bull riding did later in that there was a learning curve. And while you do have to recognize that and be willing to take it on, so there's a certain amount of courage in there to take that on because you can't be afraid of failure. I think one of your interviews on your racing show, Shug McGahee, referred to the don't be afraid to lose philosophy, and you've had to employ that more than once.
Well, thanks, Keith. I mean, that's true. You know, my parents worked very hard and were very supportive of my sister and myself. My dad's a retired federal mine inspector, and my mother, she was a retired postmaster. She had 31 years in my hometown of Eastern, 41622.
Mm-hmm. Eastern, Kentucky.
That's right. And, you know, I mean, so they instilled in my sister and myself you know, a work ethic that, you know, I don't have the calloused hands and all that my father had, but, you know, I've got a work of ethic, I think, a pretty good one. I will study. I don't wing it. I don't just show up at an event no matter what it is. And in after those first 3 years with HDNet, we're doing all these basketball games. We're doing some football games. You know, I'm thinking, this is the way to go. And Mark owns the Dallas Mavericks. You know, I mean, we're going to be doing all kinds of – this basketball thing could explode. You know, this could be great. Because I was doing about, like, a dozen games a year, and, you know, that was good. But then they started sending out these surveys, as you know, in TV surveys.
Oh, yes.
And it was multiple – it wasn't multiple choice, fill in the blank. And it was, did you watch, you know, UCLA, Arizona State? I mean, we were doing these caliber of games. Did you watch Washington State, Southern California? You know, Bradley in Northern Iowa. Yes, yes, yes. And what station did you watch it on? Well, we had the big HDNet bug, they call it, the logo in the corner. And we'd go to commercial. You're watching the Pac-10 or the Missouri Valley, the West Coast Conference on HDNet, your home for college basketball. We claimed it, at least. And like 85% of the people said ESPN. And so Mark said, I'm putting a lot of money into this, but I've been researching it, and I found this sport that young people are into, and high-definition sets are cheaper, as everything does electronically, than they were when I started this deal about 5 or 6 years ago. And this mixed martial arts is the sport they like. And I want to start doing a studio show. And I want you to host it because I want to bring a sports guy in there to host it. I don't want a bunch of screaming, tatted-up guys yelling at each other. I want to have some kind of continuity and have some semblance of a meet-the-press, sports center type feel. And then one of my dearest, dearest friends... who we'd worked together. I'd done some MMA events for a freelance gig I did with Fox Sports, actually, Boss Rutan. When I found out he was going to be the co-host, I said, yeah, let's do it. And so that's how I got into MMA. Mm-hmm. It was never planned and did 9.5 years, like 450 shows or something, studio, and then went to Japan 3 times and Korea once, calling fights, and went to Canada several times, and from California to New Jersey, we called fights on and off during this time. And again, that's a world that I wouldn't have expected, but I really enjoyed it. I had some fun. I saw Donald Trump.
Did you really? Yeah.
Was
he participating, or as he sometimes has done?
Talk about an event. It was called Affliction. The sportswear company had a falling out with the UFC, and they were going to go out on their own. They only had 2 shows. They went belly up after 2 shows. They realized it ain't that easy, but they'd signed a deal with us. And the second show we did was in Anaheim, California. There was a fighter named Fedor Emelianenko, from Russia, who was considered the greatest in the world, and he was fighting that night. And Donald Trump was an investor in this company. I don't know how much, but he showed up with some of the, I believe it was, now I know that part specifically. I'm not sure about the beauty pageant he was sponsoring, like Miss USA or Miss Universe or something that he sponsored.
Yeah.
And he had several nice-looking women that accompanied him, and they were all sitting right across from us at the ringside, and they had a ring, not a cage, for this. And I remember that, and Mark Cuban was there, and I thought, wow, there's a lot of billionaires. Well, there was 2 billionaires in this room. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
We did a horse show jumping competition at Central Park in the inaugural year of that. And it's down there at Walden Pond. If anybody's been around there, around 61st Street, you'd enter it. And it's the one that Donald Trump kind of rebuilt, kind of saved the old skating rink. Well, they had a horse show competition there. And it's the first time they ever had it, and NBC Sports Network did it live, and I'm calling it live with Melanie Smith Taylor, a gold medal winner. We've worked several horse races together, and not more than probably, 100, 200 feet away from us, they had a special owner's box, and in that box was Michael Bloomberg, whose daughter was riding, Bruce Springsteen, whose daughter was riding, Mrs. Johnson of BET and the Charlotte Hornets, whose daughter was riding that night, and Donald Trump. And they're all sitting there, and I remember Melanie said to me, should we go over there and say hello? And I said, no, the crowd, the crash would scare the horses. She said, what do you mean? I said, the median income crash of 2 pikers like us walking in there with all those billionaires. And all the, I said, they'd ask us to leave in a heartbeat.
You'd throw the dynamics completely off.
We'd ruin the whole night for everybody.
That was a high income bracket there that
you
just described.
Yeah.
Well, you've obviously had a chance to have a great number of experiences and meet a lot of terrific people as you've gone through your sportscasting career. And now you've got a new project going that I know you're excited about, the Kenny Rice Horse Racing Show. Tell me about that.
Well, you know, this started by accident. A friend of mine who used to work at Channel 36 and then left and lived in L.A. and worked for Steven Seagal for like 14 years. He came back several years ago to raise his family here in Lexington, where he's originally from. And we were just talking. He'd done a football show last fall with Mark May and Lou Holtz. He said, you know, a horse racing show, what do you think? I thought, well, you can't do a results show because, you know, you got to be on the air all the time. Sure. I mean, you got to like to go in tonight and do the results. I said, can't do that. And handicapping show, if you talk about a race on a Thursday and the horse is scratched on a Friday, you got to But one thing horse racing doesn't have anymore that they had for many years, because I worked on down the stretch for ESPN for several years, is there's not a weekly horse racing show. Now, there's handicapping shows. TVG does a good job showing a lot of races and all. But actually, to talk about the people, talk with the people, that might generate some interest if you're a casual fan or just curious to hear about these people. I don't know. There may be one out there. I just haven't heard of it. And to fill that void, because the ones that I've been on a few, it's always like, well, who do you like? You know, it's the last time they ran real well. They got in traffic problems. Okay, fine. That's good, you know. But now let's talk about you. Let's talk about Keith Elkins. Why do you like horse racing? Mm-hmm. And you tell me your story. And that's what we've tried to do. And when I've called up the people, and yeah, I've used my contacts, I've taken advantage of friendships.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
You know, Bob Baffert, Wayne Lucas, Todd Pletcher's been on there, Mike Smith, Gary Stevens. You know, I'll name drop them because I've known them, because that's what I do. I cover horse racing more. And they all kind of, they like the idea of having, like we're doing right now, that free form that, you know, I'll just kind of talk and tell my story.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have to go to commercial break. And, you know, we've had a lot of fun. We've had over 30 episodes, and I don't know how long. We actually was supposed to end at the end of the Triple Crown, and, you know, a couple of people called me and said, hey, how come I wasn't asked on the show? Okay, we'll do one more. And then we did one more, and then now we're up to 31 or 2 or 3 or something like that. So I don't know when it's going to end, to be honest.
Well, that's always a good sign when people are calling and asking how come I haven't been on yet. I mentioned having Shug McGahey on, and his I don't know if it was Lucas that told him that. Don't be afraid to lose. You know, those are the things I think in talking to people who have achieved a lot in their careers. You know, ask about what philosophies have influenced them, and things like that go across the boundaries, whether it's in sports or business or whatever field you want to achieve something in. But talking to those who have done it and finding out what's been important to them, just a little thing like that can be of influence to people, and also very interesting and entertaining as well.
Well, thank you. And it's huge. And that's what I love is hearing this stuff. And I've learned stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've known some of these people for 20, 30 years, and I didn't know that story, and they just told me. But And that's always been my philosophy. I was kind of raised to, you know, to give it a shot.
Mm-hmm.
My mother, Edith, I remember her getting up in the morning and shoveling snow out in front of the post office in the winter, and my dad going to work at like 4 o'clock in the morning to crawl, 4 miles back in the side of the hill at a coal mine to inspect it. And so every time I'd say, I'd go, really? That's like real work.
Yeah.
All I have to do is read up a little bit, maybe ask a guy a question, maybe say, hey, welcome in. Here's boxing. Here's MMA. Here's equestrian. Here's some football. Here's some basketball. Really. Let's keep perspective on this. And that's kind of been my drive. And, again, I think this the work ethic. And I never heard them complain, mm-hmm. you know, no matter what. And I know there were some days looking back on, you know, it was just real cold or, you know, like any of us, you get worn down. I never heard it, you know. I used to take a lot of red eyes. We did that show in Los Angeles, that MMA show I did with the Cubans Network for 9.5 years. So I'd take a lot of red eyes because I was also doing boxing at that time. And I remember I was telling my dad once, I said, yeah, I'm like 17, 18 red eyes this year, man. That's, you know, that's kind of throwing my body clock off a little bit. And he kind of gave me a look and kind of grinned. I thought, yeah, about like crawling in a coal mine at 6 o'clock in the morning, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
A little perspective.
That's
here.
Right.
He never said a word.
Reset the perspective
yeah,
knob a
exactly.
little bit. Yeah, I know. That's the truth. Right. I mean, any time that, you know, for instance, in minor league baseball, now the travel schedule is not what you'd call ideal.
Right.
But at the same time, like the line from The Rookie, I'm not sure where we're going, but when we get there, we're going to play baseball. So
exactly.
That will keep you going. And I told people over the 9 years that I did the games, I never sat down to do a game and wished that I was somewhere else. So you know you're
great.
In the right spot. And whatever, quote, hardships, unquote, that we
right.
that we have to, like the strange travel schedules or the occasionally weird hours or working weekends
right.
and things like that, it doesn't really stack up to real hardships. And it also is a good time to remind yourself just how much fun we're all having, too, doing this kind of thing.
The perks have been great for me. I've been blessed. My dad, Reginald, I've taken him, like I say, on some of these trips, and he's met some people. And one of the things, he's a heck of a pool player.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to do this. Sometimes I'd get this call, like HDNet, we'd do some of these just random things, and one of them was the Trick Shot World Pool Championship, like in 2004 or 2005, something like that. And so I didn't really call it because these guys tell what shots are going to do. You just have to set them up. Mm-hmm. You know, I just shut up. Yeah. I just listened. It was a lot of fun.
But they need somebody to do that. You
yeah,
to kind
they
of
did
things
it.
In
they,
hand.
And they
yeah.
always have the expert. So that's a good mm-hmm. thing. They always have the expert. And yeah. so you can... You know, I'm a lousy pool shooter, but I appreciate people that can do it.
You know how to set them up.
I know how to set them up.
I wanted to ask you about one other guest you had on the horse racing show, and your conversation with Lafitte Pinkai I thought was very interesting.
Oh,
and,
thank you.
And when you talk to people who have been at the top of an obviously extremely difficult profession to succeed in, and to hear him talk about the races he's run, the relationships with trainers, things like that, when you have an opportunity to interview somebody who has just excelled over a long period of time, that's you feel like you're learning yourself as even as you're trying yeah. to do an entertaining program for your audience. And I know that must have been a great experience for you, and I'm sure you've known him for a long time.
Yeah.
But even so, to get to talk with him at some length added to it, I would think.
Oh, it did, and you summed it up right there. I mean, that's a great thing about that is you know, and I try to stay out of the way, much as nice as you are to me right now, letting me just ramble on, even though I have not nearly the inside of a Lafitte Pinkai. But, you know, I learned from him. I'm sitting there going, wow, you know, because he mentioned a couple of guys like Sandy Hawley, guys he looked up to. Mm-hmm. They were outstanding riders, but not necessarily the guys I would think that he looked up to.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was really interesting to hear that. And among the many things. And I don't know if I've done a show yet of the 30-plus shows we've done where I've come away saying, hey, I didn't really know that, or that cleared things up for me more than I thought. Mm-hmm. And that's been the fun part about it. And I hope it's been fun for people that are just casual fans. You know, I've got a
exactly.
lot of friends that yep. are casual fans. You know, mm-hmm. I got friends that still ask me, what happened at that Derby? I still don't understand it. You keep explaining this interference thing. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, it's... Not as, you know, not like the Saints non-interference
right.
call in the playoff, but trust me, it was interference. So,
yeah.
you know, but
yeah,
yeah it's fun for them. They're kind of my audience, really.
Mm-hmm.
I figure horse racing people, I've had a few of them, that's nice, that really know the game, that they've commented like on Lafitte or Bailey when I had him on. I think he's talking about he ate like a banana for 30 years. That was
yeah.
his diet for lunch.
Yeah, and I think those are things that the casual fan can appreciate because, like you say, if you need the numbers and you know the morning workouts and things like that, you've got other good sources
right.
for those. And so, do something a little different and give people something a little different about racing. And there are so many interesting people in the
yeah.
racing business, so that gives you a chance to look into that.
Probably like yeah. you too. You know, like why did you get into sports? Because you know I would listen. And I remember they were talking about Bob Gibson used to play for the Harlem Globetrotters
right.
as well.
Sure did.
I still remember that.
Yeah.
I thought, wow, that's just fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, I love that little insight. I remember Dan Issel from Batavia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I go and look it up on a map.
Yeah.
You know, I'd hear where some of these guys were from. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember, you know, Power Memorial High School because of Lou Alcindor,
right.
as he was known then when he went to UCLA.
Right.
And you know, I know it just sounds like little things, and probably in this day and age of this instant, we can just look something up on our iPhone right now. It might sound, you know, too trivial, but I do. I think that kind of generates interest, and just hearing a bit or two from a trainer or jockey that's not necessarily the, you know, my horse runs fast and it was a tough race. I hope that it creates some interest, you know. I hope that the horse racing community gets it a little bit. You know, I was on a plane and the NTRA guy, one of the National Thoroughbred Racing guys, asked me, he said, you know, I know this cage fighting you cover, it's kind of surpassed horse racing in popularity. And I said, well, first of all, they call it mixed martial arts. And he said, well, why do you think so? And I said, well, here's the deal. And this time Fox had just signed a deal with UFC. I don't know, what was that, 4 or 5 years ago? I said, Fox is paying multiple millions of dollars to the UFC. Horse racing, with the exception of the Triple Crown and only the Triple Crown, they have to subsidize everything. They help throw money at NBC or, in this case, Fox, mm-hmm. you know, the jockey club or one of the farms or something. Look at who the sponsors are. They don't have the big beer companies and the fast food places, not on a regular basis. And the reason is because you get that excitement. And if it's a lousy fight in 15 minutes, it's going to be over and there's going to be another fight. You know, in horse racing, you got to wait a long time. Now, you have to appreciate the sport, but it's... Mm-hmm. You know, you don't cling to the 50s. Heck, in the 50s, I'd be a big deal. When I covered horse racing and boxing,
yeah,
I would have been a big deal.
Absolutely, yeah.
I was ahead of my time, Keith.
Yeah.
No, but,
yeah.
you know, seriously,
sure.
it was just a different time, and people could sit around. And there's times, as much as I really enjoy baseball, you know, I flip games off sometimes. I go, mm-hmm. okay, look, it's 7-1. It's in the eighth inning. I'm tired. I'm going to bed now.
Well, it is, I think, a reflection of how society was in that baseball and boxing and horse racing. You know, boxing, you went months between the big fights, and so really a lot of anticipation there.
Yeah.
Well, you've, other than an unknown number of Kenny Rice horse racing shows, what else is ahead for you at this stage of as we're recording in mid-August?
Well, we're talking, I've still got horse racing coming up, and the Breeders' Cup will be coming up in November. I'll be out in California for that. This will be, I don't know, about my 17th or something, Breeders' Cup for the, you know, that I have 16, 17, something like that. Mm-hmm. And then I covered some more on a freelance basis before with ESPN, so I guess like 25, 26 Breeders' Cups, something in that ballpark. And then some college basketball this winter. And then talking about doing the Olympics next year, which would be my fourth Olympics. And so that's what's on the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
We hope, God willing. You know, I don't assume anything anymore, Keith.
Well,
you
that's just when appreciate everything and assume nothing.
I really do. You know, and it's good to be at a place where I work because I don't live to work like I used to. You know, I mean, I work to live. It's nice to, you know, enjoy it, not just the financial part of it, which is a key. I'm not doing it for free.
Sure.
Absolutely. You know, but it's nice to, you know, the camaraderie still and all that. I enjoy it. I don't like to travel as much as I used to, but I can still live with it. I've got about 4 million on Delta, so that's a lot of miles. A lot of miles on me, too, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I don't, you know, I enjoy that. So, again, if as long as I can keep enjoying, I'd like to do it a few more years. I don't think I'm going to be the guy doing it into his 70s.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we'll see how it goes and just try to enjoy what we can.
Well, I appreciate you spending some time with us today while you're between flights and assignments and all, and have some time here in Lexington where you've maintained your home, I guess, all these years, right?
And, I've been very blessed. You know, honestly, I never really wanted to leave, and I know you had opportunities, and I decided to stay. I could have gone to the bigger markets, as they said, on, you know, probably a half a dozen times, and I didn't. I just thought, you know, let's see what plays out. Nothing ever really appealed to me. I mean, I've been fortunate to be all over the country and about halfway around the world, and I actually like it here in Kentucky. You know, it's home, and maybe that's a big part of it. But I was very fortunate that with ESPN, they didn't carry NBC. I don't care where you live, as long as you can get to an airport.
Right.
And Bluegrass is a nice, easy airport for me, and I like it. And they laugh sometimes. They say, well, how about you have to change, though, in, like, Detroit or Atlanta or Minneapolis? And I go, well, look, I can be at the airport, like, I leave less than an hour before the flight.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas you guys that live in New York or something, you're leaving like 2.5 hours before your flight for traffic to get there. So if you measured our time traveling, it's not too far. If I lay over an hour and a half in Atlanta, it kind of equals out to what you just did, you know.
And I love getting home to this airport,
too. Oh, me
too. That's nice. You're in your car just a few minutes
after. Get in and drive straight home. I don't have to come back from Cincinnati or anywhere. I just come straight back.
Well, I'm sure there are a lot of great assignments ahead, and wish you well, and hope you have just as much work as you want to do at this stage. And congratulations on all the great accomplishments, many of which we've talked about here today. It's been a lot of fun. And, again, thanks so much for the time, Kenny.
Well, Keith, we've had a great friendship, and over the years I cherish that more than any ball games and stuff I've seen is our friends like you that we've maintained it for a few decades now, and that's rare in this business. So thank you for having me on.
All right. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to The Sports Page with Keith Elkins, an exclusive podcast from 91.3 WUKY, produced by Alan Lytle. Our theme music is Peanut Butter and Jam by Illogical Bit, available at soundcloud.com/illogicalbit. Subscribe to The Sports Page through Google Play or at our website, wuky.org. We'll be right back.